Hey, I'm Johnny Lynch. I'm here with Glennon and special guest Clive Cookson. We're here to examine how tropes bleed across movies, video games, and TV shows. In this episode, pilots and opening sequences. Welcome to Dystropia.
Forgot what we're doing.
Episode 2. Intros.
Intros.
I suppose it's slightly different for each. So kind of like the opening episode of a series, or the kind of first mission, or the first kind of level of a game, opening 5 minutes of a film. Because, again, that's the kind of what we're trying to do with this podcast, is comparing, like, how does one trope kind of, or not necessarily a trope, but mostly they are, but how a certain aesthetic or trope or whatever is applied to the different genres, because, you know, certain things are well established in film, or well established in games, or well established, but not necessarily across them all. So
that's
just a quick recap.
Okay.
So film. Clive, what's your film? What's your opening scene? What's the one that grabs you by the testicles and then come with me on a magical journey?
Well, I wouldn't say magical, because it's, well, I mean, it's probably one of the more powerful opening sequences I've ever seen in a film.
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, totally with you.
I believe it, yeah, tell me about it, yeah. Totally.
Hey, that Rube Goldberg machine, it was magical.
But the thing is, it's kind of strange, because this one's actually an animated film. It's a Pixar film. It's definitely up there, no pun intended, but the movie is Up.
Yay!
Hey!
Oh, okay, yeah. So, yeah, it's not really a magical journey. It's let's traumatize everyone.
Pretty much.
Let's have some awkward questions for the kids to turn to their parents right now and ask in the cinema.
Yeah.
Now, I know, obviously, Pixar films obviously have very adult themes or humor sometimes. Yeah. That, you know, the parents can get, the kids might not necessarily get, but they think, oh, cool colors, look at those animals, brilliant. But, I mean, I thought it was very powerful. It's one of those ones that every time I kind of watch it, I kind of tear up a little, just because, you know, it's very sad. I mean, it obviously starts off with Carl, the main character in the story. As a kid, he's very nerdy, very shy, but he's a kid that kind of dreams of adventure, has a huge interest in aviation. And then obviously comes across this loud, bubbly girl named Ellie, who, you know, he really gets on with. She loves adventure as well, and she always talks about, no, oh, I want to move to Paradise Falls one day, you know.
That's the thing, she always talks. She doesn't actually let him talk.
She doesn't. Yeah, fantastic, but the thing is, he did say to her that, you know, he's going to bring her there one day. But fast forward through the years, they're growing older. You know, they decide they want to save up to go to Paradise Falls. But something always gets in the way, you know.
Life happens.
Exactly. Yeah. Or, you know, something happens with the car and then they have to, you know, break into their savings. But, you know, it just got really sad, you know, towards the end of that opening sequence, because, you know, basically, you know, they're growing older, you know, it's getting a lot more difficult to try and get.
You're getting invested in them as it goes along. You're seeing the little snapshots of their life that are not, like, you're seeing the main ones, and it's her in the wedding dress building the house, and you're like, that's, what a weird montage scene. They went straight from their wedding to build this house. But it's really nice. It's really a little, it serves the character as well.
Yeah, but then they grow old, and I think Carl probably thinks, oh, this one last kind of few times I'm going to be able to get to go abroad with her to Paradise Falls. Goes to travel agents, get the tickets, you know. Then I think he was about to surprise her, brings her on a picnic, but then she collapses, and then ends up in the hospital, and then unfortunately it turns out that she dies. But, I mean, that kind of gives you a picture of, you know, what Carl used to be. You know, he was a happy-go-lucky kid, you know, dreaming of adventure, fell in love with this woman that he obviously deeply cared about. And it kind of gives you a sense of what he used to be and what was the catalyst to turning him into the person that you see after the opening sequence, where he's a fella, you know, who's very grumpy, wants to stay, you know, to himself, you know, kind of, you know, shelter himself away from the rest of the world. But I just thought, you know, even for an animated movie, that opening sequence alone was just very powerful, kind of, you know, hit home, you know, how important she was to him. And
I think it's cool that he doesn't speak at the start, because he's very much the character. He's the old character. Yeah. He's not, this is an old version of this young guy who we got to know. This is, you get to see the life, but he is the old character.
Yeah.
This is a prelude to this character. I think that's it's a useful way of doing it in that sequence.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. But literally everything you said there is perfect, except for the fact you said, even for an animated film, because
True, yeah.
The most traumatic films of most people's childhoods, if you actually think about it, are
animated
films.
Technically.
Bambi,
yeah.
Yeah. So it is up there as well.
Lion
King. And then, like, when I got, like, when I started into, like, Japanese anime and stuff like that, and I was, like, beyond the likes of Dragon Ball and stuff from growing up, and, let's watch some other ones and watch some great films. Yeah, let's get more and more into these. And I've seen the likes of Akira, yeah, great films. And then I saw, like, Grave of the Fireflies, which is probably the most traumatic film I've ever seen in my life.
That was just
from
a
heartbreaking perspective, like. And yeah, so I think animated films, in a weird way, they kind of, because we so heavily identify cartoons with our childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I think once you're accepting that, yeah, I can watch an animated film, I don't care that I'm not 12 anymore. It, in a weird way, can put you in that mindset. So when you get hit by that, I don't think the montage at the start of Up would have been as effective if it had been live action.
True.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think it's just because...
It's that it's more than real. It's like the fact that she can be cut straight to fixing a house in a wedding dress. It's in your head, it's like, these are cartoon characters,
but I think it's partially because it's cartoon. Part of me straight away, it's a Pixar film, so I expect it to be family friendly, and I can let myself go back to that. You know, you put yourself in a state of mind to watch something. Mm. I go back to the whole thing of I'm being a child and watching this.
Yeah.
But also the fact that they start as kids. I think if they'd done that as live action, they would have started them as like teenagers, so then it's not as big a hit. Like, I think it's just the way Pixar do things, though.
Yeah,
it's like, let's, you know, whatever, you could have the best idea in the world, they'll still find a way to improve it.
Yeah,
true.
It's kind of annoying. Bunch of pricks.
Bringing me beautiful art and all up in my face. What do you do? I like the one. I think it's one that's fairly universally accepted. It's one that, as everyone sees it, they kind of go, oh, right. Oh, God, that opening sequence.
Yeah, exactly.
The only thing in terms of like openings that I've seen since then, like, because I think a lot of people were kind of wary of, I'm sure somebody saw it and went, that's amazing, we should incorporate that in our thing. And someone went, no, it'll never work.
Yeah.
You'll never pull it off as well. The only thing I've seen that has actually even tried it and actually does it reasonably well is Ori and the Blind Forest.
Oh, yes.
The opening of Ori and the Blind Forest is very similar to the opening of Up. But it's more with like a parent figure and a child.
Right.
And you're like, but it has that equal moment of, this is amazing. Oh no. Oh God, what have you done? It's like, yeah, so.
I like it. Yourself, then?
So I have two, because I have a film that the opening was so bad
nice.
That I thought it was a different type of film.
Right.
Okay. So the good ones, I mean, like, The Dark Knight.
Mm-hmm.
Of course.
Which is the bank scene, great scene. And I actually did go to an IMAX. I travelled to an IMAX to watch I Am Legend to see the opening of that.
Mm.
Because it was shown as a trailer before I Am Legend to be seen on the IMAX. In terms of just, like, getting you... I love the openings that do the whole... What's the phrase? In medias res. Just let's drop you right in the middle of this and get you going. And it's like my second favorite film of all time, which is Brick.
Oh yes, yes, yes.
Which is an absolutely stunning film with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. There's a couple other heads in there that you'd recognize, but like it's that opening where the opening is like finding a dead body, the main character finding his ex girlfriend dead, and then the rest of the film is. A, how did it get to that point? And then B, him dealing with trying to find out who done it and making sure that revenge, not justice, revenge is served upon them.
Yeah.
Which it's a phenomenal film. If the person listening hasn't seen it, it's like a 1930s noir detective film. But like a pulp film
in the setting of
a modern day high school.
Yes.
So like, you know, they refer to police as bulls, and it's, you know, there's the scene where he gets called in front of the deputy to give him his badge, but he's actually getting pulled in front of the vice principal. Then it's like, if you're not in class, you're gonna get expelled.
And yeah.
It's but it works so well. It's so well written. It's an amazingly well crafted film. And
it
that
is
opening,
very, very good.
That opening just sets up like it's so well. In terms of a bad film, we have to go back to Halloween many years ago, 10 plus years ago. So there's a friend of mine, a colossal film buff, Darren, and he's a huge horror fan, him and his sister. And every year at Halloween, he used to do this film marathon. I used to do it in his apartment. He lived up in City Centre. We'd go up there and we'd hit up one of the shops beforehand and get like one of the few shops still left that did like quarters of sweets.
Mm.
And you get a few quarters of sweets and you go in and you literally spend the day just watching all the horror films, like classics like Exorcist 3 and all these type of films. And we'd always have one or two new ones and one or two horrendously bad ones just to watch for a laugh. But this particular year we were like, we'll actually see if there's anything up in the cinema before we go. Yeah. All right, cool. So let's check. And we looked at good old teletext, if you remember that.
Jesus.
Yeah, I know, it's how long ago. That's how old I am. But yeah, we look up teletext for Cineworld up on Parnell Street, which is down the road from where he was living. And we see there's a film adaptation of House of the Dead.
Oh, I was really worried you were going to say Cabin in the Woods as a
no,
bad
film. No, no, no.
Worried there for a second. Okay.
No.
This is the U-Ball.
No, so that was the thing. Uwe Boll's first film.
Yeah.
And we were like, House of the Dead. Let's look this up on the internet. So we've had the laptop and we're like, some guy called Uwe Boll. Never heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, he's become like the warning flag of this is going to be an awful fucking film.
Yep.
We're like, fuck it, we'll go and see it. And it's got, what's his name? He's one of the Howard brothers. His brother's, so, director of Apollo 13.
Ron Howard?
His brother.
Right.
Who was in like the original Star Trek. He's a little small guy and... See, he's in it, and we were like, oh, such and such in it. Jürgen Prochnow's in it. And we were like, Jürgen Prochnow? Ah, great.
Yep.
And we go and see it, and the four of us go up, like four or five of us go up, and we sit down to watch it. We're like, fuck it, we'll see how it's like. From the first 10 minutes of it, I thought it was meant to be a comedy.
Mm.
Really?
Because the dialogue had us laughing out loud. And there's a bit where they're on a boat going out to an island, where there's basically, there's a rave on an island where this House of the Dead thing's going to happen. And they're on the boat on the way out. And Jürgen Prochnow is the pilot of the boat. And I was like, oh, that's a nice little nod because he was in like Das Boot and stuff like
that. Yeah.
Grand. And there's a sticker on the wall of the cabin that says, the beatings will continue until morale improves. And I'm like, okay, this is very much like a comedy film. And I like that because it's a computer game adaptation. And okay, yeah, like, you know, it's a computer adaptation of basically an on-rails shooter. It's not going to be something, it's not going to, you know, be Oscar material, but... If they're doing a comedy version, it could be quite funny.
Mm.
And then about 10 minutes in, I realised this isn't meant to be a comedy. It's accidentally a comedy. Just because of how fucking awful it is.
It is bad in a way that's confusing.
Yes.
I saw that sitting at home with people and we knew it was bad. We knew it was famously bad. And we were still watching it. When things were happening, we were pausing it, looking at each other going, what the fuck did he even try to do there?
Yes. And like, I remember it because it was... Halloween had fallen on the weekend that year. It was like a Saturday or something. And we went up to an early showing. It was about 10 to 1 or something.
Mm.
And when we went in, there was about 50, 60 people in the cinema. And by the end of the film, there was maybe 14 people left in the cinema.
Oh, Jesus.
Just, the majority of people just got up and left. But yeah, I mean, it needs a mention because that opening sold it as a comedy. Because we went in knowing nothing.
Hmm.
As his first film, we had no idea how bad Uwe Boll was as a director. We had no idea how bad his films were going to be. And we didn't know if this was comedy or not. We just saw the name and went, that's based on a zombie game. Yeah, could be interesting.
I was listening to a podcast that have a fantastic... It's not even a conspiracy theory. It's just a theory about Uwe Boll. That he is... The way he works is it's like the producers. He gets a certain amount of money to make a movie.
Yeah.
And somebody who has 20 million... but is going to lose 5 million to taxes, give him the 20, maybe not 20, give him the 20 million, let's use as an example. He puts it into a movie, and then they get like, it doesn't do anything, it gets about 20 million back, but they can take all that as profit, and they don't lose their 5 million. So there is some theory about how he is doing this, but like buying a video game IP is a really cheap way of getting just some people to get it, like some people come along. And I've watched House of the Dead, I've watched some of the Blood Rains. I've watched just some of his other movies. Name of the King. Alone in the Dark. And then I watched Postal, which is good. It's fucking surprisingly good. And every time he does a joke, I'm like, that's a really dangerous joke. That's a really sketchy joke. But it landed really well. Like, that's good South Park style humor. But I keep thinking he must have done that by accident. And each joke that lands, I'm looking at it going, oh my God.
The broken clock is right twice a day. Like,
and he does enough jokes in it that land, and I'm like, is this guy funny? Like, this is ridiculous. Was that you on the...
Yeah, yeah. But no, my actual one is Brick. Yeah, Brick is the... Yeah.
For me, again, I have I have too. I would be replete if I didn't mention the opening to Inglourious Basterds as an amazing intro to a movie. I think I hadn't seen a Tarantino movie in a very long time. And this suddenly came out. And that one by itself is a standalone short film. The bit with, what's the lad's name? Christopher Waltz comes in.
Christoph Waltz.
And comes in and he's talking to the farmer and they begin speaking in English and he's talking about how you are clearly harboring
enemies of the state.
And I was watching it and it's got all those Tarantino things of there's just something, it's like wacky, like there's always the danger of violence, of something bad's always about to happen in a Tarantino movie, but he takes out this ridiculously over large pipe and he starts lighting it and he asks for milk and then things start happening. They start doing slow pans in on someone's eyes, or he grabs the girl's wrist for a second. And you've just, it's like the first time you see Hannibal Lecter. Like, they've introduced this antagonist who is controlling the scene. He's not doing anything. He is powerful in a way that does not need to be demonstrated right now. Like, he is just absolutely controlling the scene. And it's a testament to the actor. It's a testament to the writing and the shooting of it. But it is, by itself, a ridiculously good thing. I remember seeing that the first time and leaning forward and, like, kind of going, I know something bad is going to happen. This is all building to a crescendo. Tension ratcheting up. And that by itself, I would recommend people just to go and watch that again. Remind yourself of it. It was a ridiculously good thing. And then the movie starts, and whether you like the movie or not, I think everyone should just enjoy that initial part.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those films that I like the first half hour more than I like the last hour and a half.
Yeah.
And a part of that is because, like you said, that when he introduces Christoph Waltz's character, but also when he introduced the bastards themselves and stuff like that, the intro for every character is so well crafted, and then it just kind of dicks around a bit.
Yeah. He clearly had something. This was one that was the most complete out of all of his projects, but it clearly still wasn't complete. He had just like a really strong first half to it.
Yeah.
But that is absolutely my one. I will mention on the Cabin in the Woods one, if we ever get back around to doing one episode just on title sequences, it's got my favourite one of all time, where they do, immediately they start Cabin in the Woods. You know it's a Joss Whedon pick. They subvert tropes and they have they have the blonde jock character. What are you doing reading this stupid math book?
And that's not even that, it's just, who told you about these?
I learned it from watching you, okay? Like, they've got all the weird stuff, everything subverted. And then it cuts to the two guys who are going about their day, and they're in their little cart, and they're talking about, like, the office, and clearly something bigger is happening, but they're so built up in their minutia. And then the title sequence, while they're just talking, goes, dun, dun, a Cabin in the Woods. And I saw this in there, people jumped.
Yeah, there's a screen behind it and everything. It's when they showed that, they did a really good day. When it showed here in Ireland for the first time, they showed it in Cineworld, but the IFI the same night played at 11 o'clock. The Hearthon guys had organised a showing of the original Evil Dead.
Nice.
Just so you could actually, and it was great to go back and then like watch the pair of them in the same night and just see all the throwbacks to it.
Those would bleed into each other quite well.
The Cabin itself is like the biggest nod to that. Is it is the biggest nod to the Evil Dead. Yeah. That opening is a great one.
One that I wanted to just give a shout out to, which is, again, I think people forget how good the opening is because of all the, not quite controversy, but just the ill will towards the movie, is the one for Watchmen, where during the opening sequence they just play the Bob Dylan song, The Times They Are Changing, and there's all these slow motion Zack Snyder shots, those signature shots of the alternate history that has led to this moment. And he does a lot of work in that opening sequence. He does a huge amount of work in showing that superheroes did exist, where the birth of superheroes came from. It's like guys in shitty costumes. It was the police officers who were like vigilantes. And then it showed how they became celebrities. And then it showed how the world turned against them. All within just that piece of the song. And then the movie can start and they don't have to do any more explaining. And the thing I hate most about superhero movies is the origin story is hitting you over the head with it, trying to tell you the same thing over and over again.
Wait, hang on. How did Batman's parents die?
I think
fucking stupid. Like,
they were either seeing Zorro or possibly the Phantom of the Opera, or
Mask of Zorro,
or possibly De Flitermas, or possibly some other fucking thing.
No, it was always Mask of Zorro.
Was it not? It was definitely Phantom of the Opera once or twice.
I thought it was Phantom of the Opera. No.
Maybe Shane was, no, because it was the kid was obsessed with Zorro. He made them go to the cinema, and then he made them leave early because he got scared. They wouldn't have gone if it wasn't for him. That's what part.
I think it was Pixels. I think they went to see Pixels.
Pixels.
Yeah, I think the next.
Don't talk.
Yeah, and then the parents killed themselves.
But yes, those are mine.
Oh, man. I had to give a quick shout out to, I don't know if I saw it in the cinema with you and Brian, but I definitely saw it with Brian, Tropic Thunder.
Yes.
Now, at the start, like, I thought I was just watching a few trailers. I was like, what the hell are these movies? What the hell, why are they showing an energy commercial? And then I was like, hold on, this is actually part of the movie.
Yeah.
So the fact that they started off with a bunch of just crazy trailers, and obviously Robert Downey Jr. and Tobey Maguire and Satan's Alley, Priest in Love.
Yes. That
cameo alone was just brilliant. But just had to give a quick shout out to that, because it was one of those ones where I genuinely didn't know it was part of the movie.
Mm. Fantastic. All right, Glenn, what are we on? Video games at this point.
Games. So yeah, the like with games, it's a lot trickier. I think it's a very kind of a, it's an individual experience. Mm. A game will grab you or it won't in the first few in the first few minutes, based on if it's executing well the genre it's in.
Mm.
I mean, like, if you're not a fan of first person shooters, but the opening level of a first person shooter grabs you a particular way, you might be like, actually, I really like this one. But then other people might be like, this is shit.
Yep.
So for me, like, I just kind of, it's more like around a weird theory,
mm-hmm.
around an intro, which is the recent Tomb Raider reboot.
Right.
Rise of the Tomb Raider, I think it was called. So, mm-hmm. and
the second one out of those two, was it?
No, the first one, the one where it's actually on the island, and would have come out now in 2013, and then it was 2014. It was released
on Tomb Raider.
Tomb Raider. It was a Microsoft exclusive on Xbox and that.
Yeah.
In 2013, and it was rebooted in 2014, and it's all about how Lara Croft becomes the tough, no nonsense.
It's about her rise, if you will.
Yes.
I don't know if that's useful.
So, what at the start? They're on a boat. They're trying to find this island. They find the island, storm blows the ship onto the coast, the ship starts to sink, she gets separated from her friends. Now, in the first 5 minutes of playing this game, you smash your head off about 6 objects. It just seems to be the thing. It's how she navigates the world. Yeah. Like, you know, so I don't know if she's blind. Some blind people.
It's like echolocation for
her.
Yeah,
kind of. Yeah, it's like, you know, bang a nearby surface and listen to the echo, and she just smacks it with her head. But there's a part in it where she falls down a mine shaft in the very first, like, 5-10 minutes, and she gets impaled on her lower left abdomen, and she's limping because of it, she's bleeding. And then shortly afterwards, you get to your first campfire, and she pulls it out, and there's a big scene, you know, and she's like, and she bandages herself up. And then through the magical healing powers of the fire, she's fine after that. It's never noticed again in the rest of the game, okay?
I'm pretty sure I've seen her in a belly top since then. It's not noticeable.
It's just disappeared, right? So, she's got the thinnest bandage ever underneath her tank top. But I heard a theory that when she falls down the mineshaft before she impales herself, she actually dies at the bottom of that mineshaft. And the rest of the game, with her becoming an absolute badass, and there being like a magical angry god on the island, and her, like, suddenly becoming, like, basically running around for 20 hours, being able to climb and shoot and swing her way without feeling tired or hurting herself, and falling through many a trap and banging her head off many more things without dying, was all her brain misfiring as her body runs out of oxygen as she lies dying on the bottom of a mineshaft.
Yep.
Now, it's a pretty fucked up idea, but at the same time, the game makes a lot more sense all of a sudden. Once it's that, it's like, so, like, your life flashes before your eyes, but her life was pretty boring, so it's more like, this is how I want it to be.
Yeah.
And it's like, she just, you know, so the whole kind of there being a god, and obviously, you know, it's like this weird mystical entity that she's trying to deal with, and, you know, and it's that entity's fault that she's on the island and she crashed. You know, the thoughts of a dying person. It just really makes me think of that film, The Escapist.
Yeah.
With Brian Cox in that, where it's actually, most of it is actually just his brain misfiring and all the rest. And, but yeah, I just think that, like, as an intro, when I go back and, like, I see that intro, suddenly it all makes sense. Because it's almost as a moment where
it's not just,
and that's the lethal head. Yes. That's the lethal head wound. And from now on, it's all a hallucination. We're totally fine. And it actually makes sense.
Hmm.
There are a few movies like that where you can pick the point and go, and that's where they actually died, or that's where one of the characters died and everyone else is dealing with it. And I do love those ones. I don't know which ones I can mention without spoiling it.
Well, like I said, we're going to have a spoiler warning on the start of this anyway. Yeah.
Mulholland Drive, again, going back to David Lynch, there's a great moment where if you pick a point and go, actually, if that character died at that point, the rest of the movie makes sense. Mm. Like, as much sense as it could possibly make.
David Lynch stuff doesn't really make sense. But then again, like, I don't know if you know that was originally meant to be a TV series.
Yeah, it was it was Audrey Goes to Hollywood, and it was the follow-on from Twin Peaks.
Yeah, and it was a pilot for a TV series, but they made him film an alternate ending.
Right.
So they could use it as a film if they thought the film was the way to go. And the same thing happened with Twin Peaks.
Mm.
Twin Peaks was the pilot for it was shot as a film, and they made him film. Sorry, it was shot as a pilot for a TV series, but they made him film an alternate ending so they could release it in the cinema if it wasn't picked up as a TV series. But apparently that ending doesn't make sense either. So, I mean, like, it's just Lynch.
Yeah, I think when we get to TV shows, I'll probably give a shout out to Twin Peaks as well, but it's not my main one. It's too confusing to try to explain to people who don't already know it. Yeah. And the people who already know it, they don't need me to tell them.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
For my one, I think the most powerful intro, it's not the most visually kind of gripping, or it's not the most narrative or anything, it was BioShock. It was the idea that you were watching the intro sequence, and up until that point in video games, the controller went in my lap while I watched the intro sequence, and then there'd be some indication that I'd need to pick it up. Either I'd be looking at a character on screen idling, or they would literally like, say,
move left thumbstick to look around.
Or press A, or like invert access, and there'd be
to pay respects.
Yeah. There'd be some part of housekeeping that I would have to attend to before. Yeah. And you're in the plane, you're looking at photographs, everything's... And at that point, I didn't realise everything was in-game graphics. These were the hands I would be looking at for the rest of the game. This was the character I would be for the rest of the game. And then you end up underwater, and then, like, you know, plane crashes, and you come up, and things have just floated past you in the water, and nothing happens. And I'm looking at fire in the water, and I'm looking at a lighthouse in the distance. And just that moment, that's a personal moment of me picking up the controller, moving forward, and seeing that I'm already in the game. Like, at no point was I not in the game. This is me playing the game. This is amazing. And as I move forward, things start happening around me, like the fire starts flaring and more things start creaking. And I walk to the lighthouse, which is in the middle of the ocean. It's somewhere it couldn't possibly be.
Hmm.
And the weirdness begins. And it's that idea of being thrown into the middle of a story, as you mentioned with The Dark Knight. It's things are already underway. This world already exists. We're not going to start telling you about these characters. You will have to backtrack and learn kind of how this place came to exist, but it already exists. And that was one that I think just put you in at the exact right moment in the action. And then the one, again, this is another personal one, is Silent Hill 2, the very start of it.
Mm.
I didn't notice anything about the start. I played through the entire game, but I bought the special edition that came with the making of.
Okay.
And I watched it afterwards, and it's one of my favorite games. It was one of the ones that I think is the most powerful game of all time. It told a story you shouldn't be able to tell with video games, but it managed to do it perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
But the intro sequence in that, they make you walk down a path into the town, and it's about 7 minutes long. Like, it's a really long distance to walk. There's things to look at, but nothing happens. Yeah. And you just walk until you get to the town. And the guys were saying that they did that on purpose because they really wanted to give you the feeling that you couldn't turn back. That no matter, like, you were playing this game, you were invested, that if something bad happens and you want to run away, there's no turning back. You just walked for 7 minutes. You are isolated. There is nothing. Yeah. Like,
it's not like you can just like, oh, well, I'm only like 2 minutes from the motorway.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Like, you've already invested a lot of your time in this. And when something bad happens, you're like, I got to keep moving forward. I've already come this far. And that's the contrast. There's one where you're right in the middle of the action, and the other is the slow build up.
Mm. I wonder with the Silent Hill thing, though. Like, I mean, I think that's part of why Silent Hill 2 works so well at the start, is because it's about 20 minutes before you see anything.
Yeah.
And you had that in the first one as well, but the first one, it kicks off a little bit faster.
Yeah, you see like a motorbike crash. There's an implied motorcycle crash and there's a kid on the road and stuff.
Yeah, but your first transition, the first siren, which to this day, that's like Pavlov's bell. That still creeps me the fuck out.
All that fucking klaxon.
Like, that has the effect. With the second one, it has the thing of, it's lulling you into a false sense of security almost, because I think you're expecting it. They have to change something up.
Yes.
Like, they did it with Resident Evil 2. Resident Evil 2, I remember, like, I played Resident Evil 1, like, you know, late at night, the lights off, which is the worst idea.
No, but definitely, Jesus.
Yeah, like, particularly, I think it was like 14. I'm like, play this. And I played through them. Great, but I knew when I see a typewriter, I'm safe.
Yes.
Typewriter equals safe.
Yep.
Resident Evil 2 comes along. I start playing it. I'm playing through. I get to the police station. I get into the typewriter room at the police station. And finally, my asshole unpuckers, and I'm like, okay, I'm safe. And I go to go out the other door in that room. And as I move around the corner, it's still in the room with the typewriter, a licker runs across the window.
Yes.
And I had to put the controller down and leave the room for about 10 minutes. I was just like, I wasn't ready for that, because up until that point, it was like, the sun rises in the east, sets in the west, water is wet, and a typewriter means safety. Yeah. And they just changed that, and I'm like, no, I can't handle that right now.
I know people who swear they've never played video games, and no, I never really got into it. And I said, oh, remember that? Are we watching a Resident Evil movie? And those fucking lickers.
Yeah,
like, you have played them. It's like, I thought I blocked it all out.
Yeah. It's one of those. It's an enduring image. And then when you actually see the licker for the first time, and you go through that door, and you go around the corner in the corridor, and the thing's sitting on the ceiling, and you're like, oh, no, this is gonna be a thing.
Yeah.
Because again, in the previous one, you were never worried about what was above you.
Yeah. There was no above you.
Yeah, that's the thing.
You had, like, tank controls.
Yeah. It was. It made things interesting, like, and then again, it's like they did it again. That's one thing I like about Resident Evil, is that they managed to reinvent it a few times. Mm-hmm. You go to Resident Evil 4, and it's like, okay, so now we're in somewhere in Europe. Yeah. And you're moving along, and you're like, okay, so these people are going to be zombies, and so what the fuck did just come out of his head? And it's again, you're like, holy shit, that's like a 10-foot reach. It's like, you're used to, like, I'm miles away from this guy, and look at all this ammo it's given me. Ha ha, this will be easy. And you pop someone's head, and a thing grows out, and you're like, well, that's meant to kill you. Again, you've changed the rules.
All you ever teach me, you shoot them in the head. Yeah, that's where the monsters live.
No, that was one thing I really liked with Dead Space as well. I love the Dead Space series for that whole thing of, computer games up until that point have trained us, particularly first-person shooters, third-person shooters, have trained us, aim for the head.
Yes.
And the whole point of Dead Space is, do not aim for the fucking head. Mm. Like, take the limbs out. It'll kill you, it'll save you so much ammo. So we worked out, we did a playthrough when it first came out. Me and my friends were sitting there, after we played through and actually in experienced it as a single-player event. We played through it, and we went, right, what if you only go for headshots?
Mm.
Just to see if you can, like, take them down by headshots. And you start running out of ammo very fucking quickly. If you only go for the limbs and take the limbs out. And it even says, the first time you find the gun,
it says,
it's written on the wall in blood, shoot off their limbs.
Yep.
And we were like, okay. And we went, and when you go for the limbs, you're never at risk of running out of ammo.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when you panic and you revert to the primal gamer instinct of center mass, go for the head. That's when you're like, oh, you're fucked now.
Yeah.
It's if you lose control, that's when you die. If you maintain your composure and go, no, I'm going to take his legs out first to slow him down, I'm going to take his arms. It's still a tense game, but it's perfectly survivable, which is just a great bit of design work. So.
Mm. Play the Zoro's Rex?
Yes. So, my personal favourite game of all time, Mass Effect 2.
Oh, really?
I'm probably going to choose for this one. Basically starts off with the elusive man who is played by the great Martin Sheen. Mm. And
lovely eyes in that episode.
Oh, yeah, exactly, yeah. And Miranda Lawson, who's actually played by Yvonne Strahovski, who few people may know, obviously, from Dexter or Chuck. But basically starts off with them two talking about, you know, no one will trust Cerberus. But they'll follow Shepard. Shepard's this hero, this icon that they're kind of building up. And Miranda kind of says something pretty interesting where she says, you know, if we lose Shepard, then the rest of humanity will quickly follow. You know, so it kind of gives you an indication that, you know, Shepard is, you know, the main kind of hope for the rest of humanity, which seems
kind of strange. After the events of the first one, I could kind of understand that.
Yeah.
But in a way, it was kind of like, that was one of the things that, like, I don't mind the Mass Effect series. I was just never overly blown away by it. One thing I liked about the first one was almost kind of, it's the fickle finger of fate makes you the important one.
Mm-hmm.
In the second one, it's like, there's other people going, no, he's the important one. And you're like, okay, I suppose.
But then it kind of cuts to the Normandy appearing in space in orbit just above this planet. And an unidentified cruiser comes along on the scanners, and they're like, what the hell is that? It's the Geth, you know, because they were thinking, you know, the Geth, originally they thought were the kind of main threat to humanity,
yeah.
But turned out to be the Reapers, of course. And it turned out to be a Reaper anyway, and obviously the Reaper attacks the ship.
Yep.
It's basically in bits, but then it cuts to, obviously, Shepard putting on his helmet, ordering either Ashley or Caden, whoever you save, anyway, to you know, help everyone to the escape shuttles. Then you take control of Commander Shepard, making your way through all this debris, all this fire. And kind of does something interesting where you get to, I think it's the main part of the ship where they have the galaxy map, the holodeck, and everything else. And as soon as you get out there, it just goes absolutely quiet. And all you hear is the breathing through Shepard's mask. And you're like, what is going on? Everything's, you know, kind of floating around in zero orbit. You see chairs, you see, you know, pieces of the ship just flying around. And then you kind of look up and you're like, oh, there's the moon. There's the stars. You know, basically the whole ship is kind of exposed. And you just make your way to the very end of the ship, to the cockpit where Joker is, and you see he's kind of covered by this force field. But, you know, Joker's thinking, oh, yeah, you know, I can still save the Normandy. I can still save the Normandy. But you knew it wasn't going to happen. Gets him to the shuttle, escape pod. Obviously, another explosion, another attack from the Reaper happens, and Shepard gets separated from him. He manages to save Joker just in time by manually, you know,
get him into the pod, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And then an explosion happens, and he's kind of thrust out into space. And then kind of, you know, somber kind of music hits, and you just see Shepard, you know, floating in space. Then you see there's a breach in his suit, and he's just there gasping for air. And then it kind of fades to black as he's just floating towards the atmosphere. You know, you see a bit of burning happening. And then it kind of just...
the credits roll. For anyone who hasn't played it, Mass Effect 2 is very short.
Check them out, guys.
But then kind of thrust you into the game after you hear things where, you know, oh, we found Shepard's body, we recovered it, and they were regenerating his cells and that.
It was a very nice way to do what another game would do by basically giving someone amnesia, like the, or else not addressing the fact that you got to relearn all your skills.
It's the Metroid effect.
Yeah.
Metroid, it's always like you start off and you're like, I'm super fucking powerful, and then something happens and Samus gets completely depowered.
Exactly.
And then it has to be a reason to pick up everything again.
But actually just saying, no, you died that time. Exactly. It's a really nice way of saying, had you continued a save, had you continued from one?
I did, actually, yes.
So the person that you immediately start with was your character.
Right? Exactly.
It's not just that, oh, the main character died? Huh. It is, oh, this, my character, my 100 plus hours character starts the game, like, in this really weird situation and essentially dies.
Yeah.
And it's a nice way of saying, if you want them to have scars now, you can. Like, you can mess with this person a little bit because you're kind of... you're kind of 2.0 here.
Yeah,
that was, I think that was a powerful one as well.
Yeah, and it kind of just thrusts you into the game because you wake up in a lab and then you hear Miranda talking and you're basically under attack and you're trying to escape. But I thought it was pretty good intro. It kind of built up how big Shepard is to the whole arc of the story as well, which, you know, kind of plays in the... Well, let's not talk about the third one, but... it kind of make you felt like, you know, your choices did matter and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Like I said, the series never grabbed me in a huge way. I still play through it. Like, I like BioWare games, and I will play them. Like, for me, it was always just Dragon Age was the one that got me more. Like, because I don't know. I think it's just the more removed from reality something is, the more interesting I find it, because it's a method of escapism. So, like, I prefer the Elder Scrolls series to the Fallout series, and, you know, again, for the same reason. But that's partially because shooting in Fallout is arse. So, when you go into Elder Scrolls and it's just a very simple bow and arrow or a crossbow, it's like, or a spell, it's like, yeah, this is a lot simpler.
Yeah.
Plus, I don't have the fucking VAT system holding my hand all the way through it, like, so. Which, I know they're trying to, like, obviously retain some of the real-time strategy, the turn-based strategy elements, but it's like...
That is how I ended up playing it, which is, annoys me, because I know it's a shooter in there somewhere, and I end up playing it with VATS, because I'm like, it's the same way I ended up playing Mass Effect, which was I would pause and look around, and I was like, I really don't think this is supposed to be a tactical game. Am I playing this very slow? Like, what's happening?
Yeah, it's, I don't know, I mean, like, I appreciate them trying to make it interesting and diverse and stuff like that, like, and make it stand out from the other games in the genre, but at the same time, they can do that with their stories, both Bethesda and BioWare. They can do that with their stories. They don't need to do it with their mechanics necessarily.
Yeah.
Like, they don't have to force every mechanic to operate differently than it does in other games.
Yeah.
There's a reason why like the Call of Duty series being so good at like first person shooters that they've nailed how you do just the mechanical side of the shooter, like story aside or you know setting aside, the shooting part's fine. Yeah. So just if you're making a shooter, look to that.
Yeah.
You know, like the way they looked to doing to Halo, because Halo was the one who successfully brought it to console.
Right? Yeah.
Like, don't be afraid to you know take a mechanic or an aspect and go, yes, this works well. We don't need to fix this.
Yeah.
I don't like that approach that like Bethesda seemed to have of. But everything has to be ours. Or everything has to be the way we do it. It's like, well, no, not everything does have to be like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same with like the crafting in Skyrim. It's like, well, how do I know how this works? Well, eat it. What do you mean fucking eat it?
that was incredible. The first because Skyrim was great, and the first time I picked up a butterfly, I went to use it, and it goes, you ate it. And I was just sitting there going, this is a different game than I thought it was.
It's just, yeah. You know, they could have just had it like, you know, why isn't there an analyze button? Why isn't there, you know, go to the apothecary and go, what do these do? And he goes, well, let me tell you. You know what I mean? Like,
you gained health. That's fairly straightforward.
Exactly.
You cured your vampirism. I had what? I had vampirism? For when?
So, TV series.
Is that me to start?
TV series. What jumped out at you?
I think we alluded to it there with the Twin Peaks one, that I think the opening of TV series, and in fact the pilot episodes of TV series, the ones that really jump out at me are the ones that have the mystery box. The one that J.J. Abrams has done a whole TED talk about, this idea of the mystery box, of setting up something that, you know, grabs people, and, you know, David Lynch calls it the golden goose, the central question that needs to be answered, and you set that up in the pilot, and then arguably never reveal it, never explain it. So that to me is something that just hugely appeals to me. So with Twin Peaks, it was the character of Dale Cooper driving to this town, describing the trees, talking to a dictaphone to an unseen character. You know a murder has happened at this point. You know it's a serious situation. The just weirdness of all that is really, really beautiful somehow. I think then following on from that, Fringe had a good opening episode. Lost, which I've never seen. Never watched a single episode of Lost. So many different people have told me the opening of Lost, have described the pilot to me in so much detail that it has to, like, that I feel like I've seen it. I kind of know that.
Yeah.
I can see the plane crash. I can see the island. I know what happens in Lost. But the one that I think encapsulates that well, it has the right amount of mystery to it, is the opening, the first episode of Battlestar Galactica, the 2004 series, which you said to me is a mini-series.
It was originally a two-part mini-series that they were basically floating as a test to see if it was worth adapting into a series.
And that to me is the best opening of any TV show ever, of absolutely anything, because they didn't just have to say, here's the story and here's what we're setting up. They had to sell you on watching this level of sci-fi. They had to sell you on watching this kind of show as well. And there's so much in that opening episode. Because it's about... The show isn't about there are robots. The show is about sex and politics and, like, the humanity. And
humans are the real monsters all along?
The human aspect of absolutely everything. And they managed to sell that all in the opening episode. And again, it starts with beautiful woman... It starts with people having sex. It starts with her killing a baby at one point, which nobody seems to remember.
Yeah, just reaches into the pram and, click.
And then a nuclear weapon going off. And I remember seeing that and just being like sitting there going, this is the greatest piece of television I've ever seen in my entire life. How is, like, where does the show go from here? And then it goes into submarines in space and everyone trying to keep their head down because there's depth charges.
I like how it's a soft reboot and how the original series still happened.
Yes.
But it's... Like, let's reuse the character names because people are familiar with them. Let's reuse we're on the museum ship. And it's like, well, tough, like, shit, it's the only one you got now. Like, and
there's a bit in there where I think they meet with the Cylons and they go into a room and, like, the robots are there, the humans are there. And that's the least memorable part of the whole
episode. Yeah, it's the first episode where they have this one station and it's a nod to the one that's on the border of the North and South Korea border, where there's an entrance from both sides. At the same time every year, they send someone. And the Cylons never send anyone back, so no one's seen a Cylon,
yes,
as far as they're aware, in like 30 years.
Yeah.
And then the guy's there and he's just like, you know, he's whatever, like he's dicking around because he doesn't expect to see one. And then the door opens and the two Cylons walk in. Now I remember watching the original one growing up, and because it wasn't one that like my friends knew about and my friends were talking about. It was like my brother was like, you should watch this. And
yeah.
I'm like, okay, let's see it. And I'm watching them like, this is really good. And when they come in at the start, and the bit that got me was when they walk in and I'm like, yeah, okay, this looks all right. They look good. And I went through that whole, like, you know, half second argument with myself in my head of like, sure, that animation's a bit robotic. That, don't be fucking stupid. Of course it's robotic. And like the, and then, but then it is the bit where they've got their, they've got the gun
mm-hmm.
on the arm, and then they just kind of flick the wrist and the hand forms around it. And I was like, that's really nice. I'm interested.
Yeah.
And then she walks in from the Cylon side. And I'm like, wait a minute, what's going on here? Because like I said, it was a standalone
yeah.
thing. We just heard they're doing a Battlestar.
Yeah.
And we're like, okay. And I remember my friend went down on it and he was like, tell me about it. And I was like, alright, watch it. And he didn't tell me anything about it. He was just like, you just have to watch this. And I'm like, alright, fine. And when I saw that bit, and then like she leans across the table and kisses him, and then it just blows up, and I'm like, okay, you have my attention.
Yes.
let's see this happen. The actual first episode of the series is the bit where they're on the timer.
So that it's interesting to hear that, because I hadn't seen the original series. That to me was them selling it to me cold. Like they had to sell me on the concept, they had to sell me on the fact that there was already history, mm-hmm. they had to sell me on the fact that this wasn't going to be like dense sci-fi, that there was going to be the drama element to it, and it successfully sold me that. So it's interesting to hear your side of them that it coming back to you and saying, "All right, so we're picking up where we left off. Oh no, everything's different. Okay, let's do this."
The fact that like one walks in and it's humanoid, like, because originally it was just guys in chrome plastic suits,
yeah.
You know what I mean? But it was still a great show.
Mm.
It was ridiculous. They do get to Earth at one point, and then they're like, they have flying motorbikes, so you know that's a thing. There is actually a scene where they're riding along and this biker gang like pull up beside them and like, hey, pull over, we want to talk to you. And they're like, yeah, it's not happening, buddy. And they just flick a switch and take off and fly away, and the whole biker gang crashes, and they're like, oh my god, look at that. It's like it you know, it had its elements of ridiculousness, but at the same time it was for like old style sci-fi. I remember being very memorable because of the Cylons mm-hmm. were like, these are really good,
yeah.
Like iconic bad guys for me growing up. They were the ones that stood out. So when I was watching this and he comes in, I'm like, oh, it's not a guy in a suit. Mm. Okay, animation, yeah, fine. And then did the bit, and I was like, okay, now I can appreciate why they've gone CGI with them. Because
mm-hmm.
they obviously just could have tooled up the suits.
Yeah,
and
true.
Done them as, you know, and it would have worked. But when I did like that, I was like, okay, I'm on board.
Yeah.
And then when a human appearing Cylon walked in from their side, I was like, oh, okay, so we're changing the entire state of play here. Like,
I really loved that as they were doing it, they'd set up these rules. I'm like, I'm so invested, I know the rules off by heart. And then they just break them a couple of episodes later. I'm like, okay. I was so fine with it. I was like, we can't tell that they're human, or we can't tell that they're not human. I was like, didn't her spine glow when she has sex? Just have sex with everyone.
Just, you know, engage in a relationship, you know, and it's like, I think it's time we do a reverse cowgirl. I can't, I'm sorry, it won't work. That's all along, you're obviously a fucking Cylon then. And actually, the whole thing, over the course of the series, it's revealed that so many of them are, I was a Cylon and I didn't know, and it's like, and your fella never noticed? I mean, what's going on here, like?
He was busy, all right?
He preferred.
He likes it blindfolded. It's like, all right, fair enough.
Oh, man. Introduced me to Trisha Helfer, so can't complain.
Yeah, not
a bad thing.
Like, I mean, a few came to mind when you originally mentioned it. Like, I think Dexter was one of those ones that kind of originally came to mind. But my personal pick would have been Breaking Bad.
Because
I think straight from the get-go, you see Walter White, you know, in a camper van, mask on, everything else. You know, he's driving with some passed-out guy in the back that we obviously find out later on to be Jesse. And, you know, his mask gets so fogged up that, you know, he has to, you know, dump the camper van at the side of the road. And then he obviously walks out of the camper van, the iconic shot of him in his tidy whiteies. But then, you know, you hear sirens and, you know, he starts recording a message for his family saying goodbye and all this kind of stuff. And you're like, what the hell is going on? And basically, as the sirens get closer and closer, you see, you know, Walter White with his gun. So he's obviously expecting the worst.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it just cuts to you know, the first main scene in the film, and you're like, Jesus
and,
Christ.
And then it switches to what is essentially like a less funny Malcolm in the Middle version of him, and you're like,
yeah,
okay, there's a disconnect here, what's going on?
But I mean, right from the get-go, it kind of tells you, Jesus, this lad's in serious shit.
Yeah.
Don't know what it is, but I really want to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very good hook, like, and I think it was that they... I wonder, I've not followed like commentaries or anything on the thing. I've watched the series, but I haven't gone back like that the way some fans have. But I wonder if it was a decision on their part to say, okay, you're most well known for the character of
yeah,
Hal.
Yeah, of course.
You know, we need to break that from minute one.
Mm.
And that's why they set it up like that.
Yeah.
So it's not just... Like, there's, you know, that type of series, because it's a character that's meant to change so much,
yeah.
There's several different ways you could do the whole, let's grab you at the start.
Yeah, yeah.
But the, like, it could easily just be him, and like, you know, over a stash of drugs, and he hears sirens, and it's like, you know, and then it's like, okay, well, how did he get into this situation, you know?
That's me. You're probably wondering how I got
here. Yeah, exactly. That type of situation. But I wonder if that whole, okay, we're going to show you in your underwear, which in a way actually has a lot of nods to Malcolm in the Middle.
It does,
the whole
yeah.
joke of like him, you know, like he's so hairy, she has to shave him and all this.
There's a whole episode of him in his underwear.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm like, okay, so in a way it's familiar,
yeah,
but different very quickly, yeah.
It, from watching Bring Me Out, I realised how much of a straight man he was in Malcolm in the Middle. The fact that he was completely unfazed by everything in that, the Hal character, that he... It's always hinted at that he's this amazing fighter and that he's got all this mad stuff in his past and there's so much going on. Like, clearly the boys get it from him. It's, like, not from nowhere that it's coming from.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like it's... With Malcolm in the Middle, like, it seems to be that he knows 100% that he is the reason they're like that.
Yeah.
Mm.
And he just runs with it because he's been in that situation.
Yeah.
Like, there's the whole... That scene where he just... In one of the episodes at the start of it, he just comes in and he's like, who wants to make $5? Because the three guys... the three kids are all sitting there doing their homework. He's like, who wants to make $5? And they're like, what did you do? And he goes, oh my God! And he's like... And they're like, all right, $10. But it's just... He knows that, like, you know, yeah, when I was that age, I would have, like... I would have done that for my dad. Like, that type of thing. So... And he is, like, the biggest kid in the family.
Yes,
like,
yeah,
so.
Absolutely.
Which is a great thing, yeah.
But then in Breaking Bad, he, the fact that they can put him in a lime green shirt and his tidy whities, gun in hand, in the desert, and have the cops peel past him, basically says to me, yeah, he's still the straight man. Like, we can put him in any situation we can think of, and you will believe it. It's perfect. Like, it is a really strong start.
Yeah. I think the whole series benefited from the fact that they said, okay, it's only going to be this many seasons. This is going to be a story. That is it. You know, they didn't decide, oh, you know what? We're going to extend
it. Lost did.
Yeah.
Let's make it 2-season, 6-season series. Yeah. Fucking, that does my head in with Lost.
Are they in purgatory? No. Quick, write down something else. Anything else. Just write down anything else.
They were flexible, though. Like, even though, like you said, they had a set number of episodes that they wanted to do and all the rest. Like, Jesse Pinkman
was... He was meant to die, wasn't he? Yeah, in the first season, yeah.
So, like, the fact that they were like, okay, we can adapt it. We can flex around that, and it gives it more interesting stuff to work with. That shows, you know, it's a good creative team behind it.
Exactly,
yeah. Like, now, my ones... So, Fringe will be my main one. Partially because, so I'd heard a lot about Fringe, and I was the most skeptical person on the planet going into watching that. I am a colossal X-Files fan.
Yep.
So it was like, it's a new X-Files, and straight away I'm like, no, it fucking isn't.
How dare you?
Yeah, yeah.
How dare you sit where he sat?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm like, you can never replace him. and then it was like, oh, and it's... the guys who made Lost, and I was like, that's not a positive.
You already have one middle finger up, and the second middle finger starts going up.
At this point, I'm like punching walls, and I'm like, argh! And then they're like, you know, and it's got Pacey from
Are
you fucking kidding me, right? And so I'm like, okay. And I heard, no, it's really good, watch it.
Yeah.
Now, I watched the first episode, and I was like, I was sitting there, and I'm like, but if I'm honest with myself, and when I rewatched the series, because I've rewatched it twice now. When I rewatch the series from like 2 or 3 minutes in, I'm like, oh, now I remember why this is a really good show.
Yes.
Mm. But the first time I watched it, I was like, no, I still don't like this. Like, even half an hour in, when I'm like, this is really good, I'm like, no, it's shit, it's still shit. But I'll watch it till the end anyway. I was the most begrudging bastard on the planet watching that thing. And it was part of it is because, so for me, the defining features of the X-Files has always been the female skeptic, the male cynic, but who's actually like dreamer, a believer.
Kind
of,
yeah.
No, a believer, but has what I now realize to be like the entire foundation for my sense of humor. Going, because I'm watching through the X-Files now, and I have to say, even though I was a huge fan of the X-Files growing up, and I religiously watched it, was the first TV series that I ever went, I need to set an alarm to make sure I don't miss this.
Yeah.
I can't go to whatever because the X-Files is on.
Yeah.
It was the first TV series that ever did that for me. I never watched them a second time.
Because
in a way, I was kind of afraid of, like, is this just nostalgia?
Yeah.
Will watching it a second time make it shit?
Yeah.
And I said, fuck it, bit the bullet, I should say. And I started watching them again a few weeks back. And they're as good as I remember.
Yeah.
And I'm grand. But now when there's so many jokes and so many sarky one-liners from Fox Mulder that I don't remember, because it's the episodes, the scary parts, it's the exciting parts that jump out to me, but it's actually his sense of humor. I'm like, oh, that explains so much about me. and where I got all that from.
His whole character is supposed to be that he's been researching this stuff for years and years and years. And the sense of humor works so well with that character.
Yeah.
And there's a bit where it wasn't in the first season, it was in the later season, where they open an attic to go up there to investigate something, and a dead body falls out, but it's so heavily decomposed it's nearly grey. This horrible mass slumps out, clearly a body. And they both stand there for a minute, and Mulder just goes, "Do you think the fall killed him?"
But it's even like there was a couple of lines in it that I'm noticing that I think were improv'd.
Yeah.
And because David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson had worked so long together at that point, that it was just fine. There's one episode called Detour, where it's not even they stumble across an X-File. They're driving to an event,
right,
with another set of agents, and it's another male and female set of agents. And they're really cheerful. They're going to a team building exercise, and it's like, you know, Mulder's in the back seat, and every time they're like, you know, oh, have you ever been to one of these? Like, we go every year, and he's like, no. Strangely enough, I come down with a very bad case of diarrhea this time every year usually, and then you're just kind of like, all right, and you can even see like Gillian Anderson's like trying not to laugh, you know, because her character she's meant to kind of scowl at him, but she's trying not to laugh, and then like they stumble across the X-File, and there's a bit where he's injured. Right, and they're like against a log, and for body heat, she starts pulling them over, and he's just like, and it's just kind of half-assed, like, no, I don't want to wrestle, and it's just that's amazing delivery, like, oh, you know, he doesn't try and like drive the joke home. It's just real kind of, no, I don't want to wrestle, and it's so well done, and I'm like, you know, that explained a lot of my humor. So it's like going into Fringe, I'm like, it's got to have that sarky sense of humor. Got to have the sense of humor where it's just out of nowhere. And they introduce, Olivia Dunn first. You know, all right, fine. Go for her first kill. And same thing happened with the X-Files. The X-Files opens with Scully being brought into the assistant director's office. Like, so I'm like, all right, cool. This is fine. And I'm like, yeah, we're following the same thing. And it's very much a homage to that first episode in a way. And I'm like, great. And then they bring in Josh Jackson's character. And I'm like, okay, right. And Peter Bishop, we're fine. And again, I have this holdover from fucking... Every time I see him, all I hear is, I don't want to wait. Just in my head. And I'm like, all right, fine. Right, we'll see how this goes. And I'm like, okay, this is fine. And then John Noble as Walter Bishop is a fucking masterpiece of acting.
Absolutely.
And I'm like, I look at him, I'm like, Denethor? And then there's a bit in the, I think it's in the first episode or the second one, because they did a marathon to catch up. When I first watched it, it had already been on for like 2 or 3 weeks on Sky, and then TV3 got the rights to show it as well.
Yeah.
But part of their deal was they weren't allowed to get ahead of Sky.
Yeah.
So what they did was they started like, and you have to start a month behind, and you're not allowed to get ahead of them, and they're like, all right, fine. So they did an opening night marathon of 4 episodes and caught up. Right. And then they were just the next day.
Yeah.
So if you didn't want to watch it on the Friday, you watched it on the Saturday or whatever. Or no, if you didn't watch it on the Friday, you watched it on the Sunday. They were two days after.
Yeah.
And I was like, so watch the marathon. And it gets to the bit, and it's like a second episode, I think it is. And they're driving along in the car. And Walter's like, they're saying something real deep in thought and, you know, talk, discussion. And Walter's like, oh, and they're like, what's wrong? He goes, I just pissed myself. Yeah. And he's like, what the fuck is this? Like, and that made it. It was his character. And as it went on, it was really well developed in that. But and like in the opening, his character, and then the fact that they just go balls to the wall with the disturbing visuals.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like the translucent skin, the people melting on the plane. And I'm like, cool. And it has Lance Reddick in it as well,
Lance Reddick.
Yeah, like I'd seen him in Oz and he was fantastic in that, and he shows up and I'm like, Lance Reddick's in this.
And that was about the time The Wire was pretty big as well, wasn't it? So
it's just after,
so
after
for him. Them it was a pretty big, you know, kinda
big get to get him, and I was like, yeah, okay. And like I said, like I was all the way through, I'm like, no, I don't like it. Zooter episode, great. I mean, shit. Okay, I guess I'll watch it. I only have about 100 other channels. I suppose I can leave this on. But yeah, it was, for me, it was an opener that, like, it had a lot to live up to for me.
Yes.
Yeah. And it managed to hit all the right beats. And like you said, when it introduced your man, and it's like, and then he's like, I love you. And I'm like, oh, he's so dead. He's so fucking dead. That guy is, he's either dead or deformed by the end of this episode.
I was like, he doesn't look like he's going to turn into the bad guy, so he's probably dead, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's one or the other. Like, and it turned out to be kind of both, but not. It was weird.
That first episode was the one with the aircraft.
Yes,
and they could have just done a Blues Brothers thing where they were getting the band together.
Yeah.
Or they could have done a Monster of the Week and then, like, maybe introduce characters later in the series. And they managed to do both very, very well.
Yeah, it was very much kick the door down from minute one, and then just, and like the band has to get together as a result.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, and it was very good standout. The other one I want to mention, and it's not an opener, but like it was the kind of, I marathon seasons quite a lot. And we did discuss this outside of this, was the Clerks animated series, where the second episode is a flashback episode, where the second episode spends most of its time flashing back to the first episode and earlier parts of the second episode. And as an opener to a series, like, the first one was good, particularly when you start realizing who's doing the voices, because obviously you have the main characters are voiced by their film counterparts, but then you have the character, they live in the town of Leonardo, and they introduce this character called Leonardo, who is meant to be like the bad guy for the whole thing because he wants to set up a superstore across the road from them.
Yeah.
And you find out he's voiced by Alec Baldwin. Yeah. Just like, okay, that's fine. Because he's in full-on Bond villain mode.
Yep.
And he doesn't even realize that, and you're like, this is fantastic. And then they just do a flashback episode. I'm like, I am totally on board with this series. So yeah, not quite an opener, but close to it, and in a very unique way. So, yeah.
Cool.
Nice one.
I'm more than happy with all the things we've mentioned. The end.
That's our show. Thanks for listening, and remember to check us out at Dystropia on Facebook and Twitter.